Welcome to Crime Lapse. I'm Eileen.
And I'm Charlie.
On a spring Saturday night in Cork City, Nicola Sweeney and Sinead O'Leary were sitting in Nicola's bedroom doing their hair and makeup, completely unaware that someone was downstairs. The intruder made his way through the unlocked side door into the house, turning off lights as he walked the hallway to the stairs. He quietly ascended to the second floor, still darkening the route as he went. He didn't say a word as he entered the bedroom, before unleashing an attack that would leave one of the women dead.
Josephine and John Sweeney welcomed their first child on October 6, 1981. Their little girl was born 6 weeks early in Bon Secours Hospital, County Cork, a blessing to her parents, who had lost three pregnancies before. They named her Nicola. A year later, the young family moved to London, where John became the licensee of the Archway Tavern. They had another child a short time later, a baby boy they named Sean. Every summer, the Sweeneys would go back to Ireland for a holiday, visiting their grandmother in County Kerry. It was the rural Irish landscape that sparked Nicola's love for the countryside and animals. She was compassionate from a young age, a vegetarian who would even stop to bury animals that had been knocked down along the road. Nicola attended St Joseph's Primary School before going on to Lesser Union in Highgate, London. She loved horse riding, music and drama. She sang in the choir at the local church and started Irish dancing in the parish hall. Nicola longed to move back to Ireland. She always asked her parents if they could go back, and in the late 1990s, she got her wish. A gorgeous hilltop house with harbour views and land had gone up for sale in County Cork. Nicola had always emphasised how much safer life in Ireland would be, and with a gated driveway and high walls surrounding the house, no one could argue with that. Underwood House was in Rochestown, a suburban residential area southeast of Cork City, in the south of Ireland. The city centre was just 5 miles away, and there was an equestrian centre just across from the house. It was a dream home. Soon after moving to Ireland, the Sweeneys had another baby, Christopher. Nicola adored having a baby in the house, and life was perfect. She attended Skulmurra Secondary School in Cork City. It was in fifth year that she met Sinead O'Leary, one of her dearest friends. They sat their leaving certificate exams together before leaving school to begin their adult lives. Nicola had a part-time job in a cafe at Brown Thomas, a department store in Cork City, and she planned on getting a business degree at Skerries College. Sinead had moved to Dublin to attend Trinity College, but they remained as close as ever.
I met Nicola when I was 16 in fifth year in a school in town, Scover, Cork City. We both coincidentally had moved back from London around the same year. We both had grown up in London and moved back to Ireland after both being born in Cork. So naturally, we used to spend a lot of time together in school and things, and our friendship blossomed. As we got older, we only had a year or two out of school, and I was in college in Dublin at the time, and I didn't want to be there anymore. I wanted to be back in Cork. I remember calling Nicola a lot that year, and I just wasn't happy there, and I really missed home, and she was a great comfort to me at that time. Nicola had a lot of friends. She was a very social person. A really outgoing girl, so definitely after school she really kind of came into her own and got to know so many more people, so she was really popular that way.
Nicola's father John remembers her as being magical. He said, "Nicola was our only daughter. She was full of kindness, love, affection and consideration for all other persons, animals and indeed all living beings. Nicola saw good in everyone, being extremely generous and truly caring. She would always bring back a present, no matter how small her pocket money was. She would insist in giving to the needy, and would never pass a charity collector without giving. She was very responsible, taking great pride in her family, her work and her home. She gave guidance and much love to her younger brother Sean, and endless affection to her little brother Christopher. Nicola and her mum were very close. They were like twin sisters going shopping and visiting the city centre cafes and restaurants regularly. I had a wonderful relationship with her. Many long car journeys from London and elsewhere were made very short when Nicola was present. Her company was truly special, and hours seemed like minutes. Her unique personality made us feel so privileged. We were immensely proud of this fact that was so obvious to anyone who had even the briefest of meetings with her. We thought her life before her would be a very happy one, and in turn would enrich our lives. We looked forward to the day when we could hold her children.
On the 27th of April 2002, Nicola finished a shift at her part-time job in Brown's Cafe and headed home to Underwood House. Her parents, John and Josephine, were in London with their youngest son, Christopher. They often travelled over for business. It was Easter break and Sinead had come back from Dublin. She arrived at Nicola's house with a movie for them to watch. Probably bored and not wanting to miss a chance to unwind, Nicola and Sinead had a change of plans and decided to head out.
And I remember coming home for the Easter holidays and then being like, oh, that's it, I'm not going back. And kind of hiding out in her house, so to speak, for the week. So I remember I stayed at her house on like Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night. And then on Friday, I had gone home and there was one of my neighbours, Paul, was having a party and he was in Nicola's brother's year in school. So actually Nicola's brother, Sean, was up there that night at the party. Nicola was at home on her own that night. And then on Saturday, I remember my mom dropping me up in the evening. I didn't know if I was going to go or not, I think. Maybe that's why I went up so late. Because I didn't end up going up till about 8 o'clock that night. And my mom drove me over and I took things out of the fridge from home because Nicola liked me to cook for her because I was not bad at cooking. Yeah, I just remember being there that evening cooking for her. We were watching down, there was something on that she was really into, some Stars in Their Eyes type thing or whatever the equivalent was. And I think it was Stars in Their Eyes though. And there was a girl from Cork on it. So she was really interested in that. And we had planned to watch movies, but Nicola's phone was going off. As it was at that age, I was 19, Nicola was 20. It was Saturday night. And a lot of people were texting her to see would we come out, even though we had decided we were not going out because it was my birthday the next week and we were going to be good and stay in. And the temptation won out. We were like, yeah, right, we'll go into town. We had a plan to go in. So we went upstairs to her room, I think around 10. Yeah, it was really late. It was late enough for a Saturday night at that age to be getting ready to go. We would have liked to have been out a lot earlier.
They went up to Nicola's bedroom to get ready. Sinead was sitting on the bed, curling her hair, while Nicola was in the ensuite doing her makeup.
So we went upstairs. I think I had a shower and then I remember I was almost ready. I was sitting on her bed, curling my hair and finishing. I finished my makeup at that point and I was curling my hair. And Nicola was in her ensuite doing her makeup. She was out of the shower at that stage and everything as well. I think it was like panic stations as to how long more we were going to take and things like that. And Nicola's brother had come up to us and said that he was going out. So he had left the house at that stage. And we had rang a taxi, I think around 10:30, to say we should be ready around 11. And I think we were supposed to ring him back again. So I think the last thing I talked to Nicola about, I remember turning around to her and asking her, oh, should I ring Dave now? We're almost ready now, you know, because he'd only be about 5 or 10 minutes away. Then I don't even remember what her answer was. I assumed it would have been yes.
The taxi was due to arrive around 10 minutes later. It was just before 11 p.m. They were chatting and rushing to get ready. They didn't hear the side door open or the sounds of the lights being switched off downstairs. They didn't hear someone moving down the hallway or coming up the steps towards them. The first indication that something was happening was when Sinead saw a man standing in the bedroom doorway. Before she had a chance to react, the man knocked her to the floor and began beating and stomping on her.
Because then I just remember seeing someone at the end of the corridor, so her bedroom, where I would have been sitting on the bed, faced straight out the bedroom door and down a very long corridor. It was the whole length of the top floor of the house where it met the stairs. And I just saw someone appear there and start walking really fast towards me. Obviously, I was caught off guard, but because of his age, he looked to be around the same age as me and Nicola, maybe younger. I was like, oh, is this one of Nicola's brother's friends who I don't know? Or, you know, is this someone who just, you know, or knows Nicola? But, I mean, you'd still be kind of, there was a sense of an alarm well at someone, you know, upstairs in the house. It's a bit strange. And then he just kept approaching me, didn't speak. I stood up and he threw me onto the ground, because I remember just being on the ground and just no words. He didn't speak, just with this really intense, angry expression on his face. And I screamed to Nicola, because he was stamping on me, just stamping all over my body. And I screamed to her and she came out. I just screamed her name. And she came out of her ensuite, which was the opposite side of the bedroom. And I remember she was screaming at him to stop. And all he did at that time, he just turned to her and just looked at her really menacingly and just lifted up his shirt to show her two knives tucked into his belt and to show her what he was about to do. Still, he didn't say anything. Just pulled out the knife and started stabbing down on top of me. And then Nicola was screaming. It was all really fast and furious, and she was begging him to stop. And I just remember just throwing the knives were coming down on my stomach and my chest, so I just instinctively threw my arms, mainly my right arm, up into the knives to take the brunt of the blows that were coming down. I think he was very focused on watching Nicola at that point, so she wouldn't run, or just to see her reaction, as if he was enjoying seeing her see that happen to her friend. And then as quick as that, he launched at her. Then I think what had happened at that stage was the blade of the knife had actually broken in my arm, so he lunged with the other knife towards Nicola, and she tried to get into her bathroom ensuite. And I remember just trying to get myself up and seeing her close the door in. And then I knew I had to just get help, that I needed a phone immediately, that this is just get help. I think at this stage I had stab wounds in my, three in my chest, two in my stomach. It's mainly my arms were really bad. They were because the knife went in and out the other side of my arms and a lot of different places up and down my right arm. So I ran to go towards her parents' room, which would have been at the top of the stairs. And so my thought process would be there would be, you know, a house phone in the bedroom, because a lot of times people had house phones in the bedrooms then. But then, because I thought Nicola had gotten into her bathroom, that he was going to be behind me. So I remember I just was like, no. When I got to the room, I was like, no, you need to keep going. You have to get away from him. He's coming now. And I sat down the stairs, blood everywhere. Because at that stage, it was like squirting out. It's like a horror film. It was like squirting out of my arm, which was just weird and unexpected to even try and process that was happening. So I slipped down the stairs and everything was pitch black downstairs. Which obviously we'd left the lights on when we went up to get ready. And I knew there was a bathroom in the middle of the downstairs of the house. So I knew that would have a lock on the door. It was a bathroom. So I just ran to get to there, to get in there. I remember fumbling with the lock to try and lock it. I was losing the use of my hands because of the wounds at this stage. And just trying to just quiet myself down and calm and think about what I was going to do next. And then I went up to the mirror. But I always remember looking at myself in the mirror and just the blood everywhere, because I was still trying to process myself what had actually just happened to me. you know, and then seeing the blood everywhere to try and actually understand, okay, you've been stabbed a lot. So then I was just really quiet, and then I could hear his footsteps coming down the hall. So I just kept really quiet and still, because I thought he was going to, I don't remember him trying to go at the door or anything, but I assumed that he was going to go outside and come through the bathroom window. And so I just listened to him walk past the bathroom door and then waited for a few seconds, and then he didn't come at the window. And then I didn't know what to do next. I was like, okay. Just call Nicola, she'll help you. You just need to open the door and call her and she'll come and help you. So I remember the same thing, trying to open the locks of the doors, and just like my hands wouldn't do what I wanted them to do. Like they were really, both of them at that stage had been ripped open, and I couldn't even get it open. So I managed finally getting it and having to open the dark into just pitch black. And that was frightening. That was really frightening. And not knowing if he was there or not, if he had come back in, and I was calling Nicola's name and then she didn't answer. And then I was like, oh God. I hadn't realized then that maybe she's not okay then, you know. So I just ran for it. I was like, just go for it. Just run. Just keep going. Just don't think till you get to her room.
30 seconds passed without any sound. So Sinead unlocked the door and called Nicola's name, and she didn't answer. Sinead climbed the stairs, dizzy from blood loss but determined to help her friend. In the bedroom, Nicola was lying face down on the floor, outside the ensuite, near the window.
So we're running up to her room, and getting in and closing the door behind me, and looking for her, and I just found her lying with her face down near her ensuite, but she was in the bedroom. She had a window seat there, and she was just lying down on the floor and she was moaning. So I just sat down with her and told her that everything was going to be fine, but that I had to get help now. So I remember leaving her and going to sit against to get her phone and sit against the bedroom door, because it didn't have a lock in case he was going to come back. So I sat down there and I was telling Nicola we're going to be fine. I was ringing the police, and I remember ringing, was it 112 or whatever it was then? It was her mobile that I'd found, and just getting really freaked out and frustrated because I was being put on hold, and I was worried I wasn't being believed because what I was saying sounded so unbelievable. And I was trying to give the codes to the gates because Nicola lived, like her house, like the bottom of the driveway was big walls and electric gates. So I was giving them the codes, and then I hung up from them, and I just didn't believe that they were going to come. So I rang the ambulance service then and did the same thing. And then I rang my dad. I rang home, and I live, my parents' house would have been, I think it's about, I think it's like 11 kilometers from, not 11, it's like 11 minutes, 7 or 8 minutes. I'm not sure. It's Montanati anyway. And Nicola's parents lived in Rochestown. When we were ringing my dad and just being like, screaming at them, I was like, I've been stabbed, you have to help me, you have to believe me, you have to believe me, was something that I kept saying to him. And we have to come and help us. And then my dad left immediately. My dad and my brother, my older brother and my mom jumped and drove out straight away. I thought she was fine. You know, in my mind, she was just unconscious and I was getting help, and everything was fine, that it would be grand. Because enough people were coming now that this would all end very soon, that we'd get help and this night would be over.
Nicola had managed to get into the ensuite but was unable to lock the door. The attacker forced the door open, kicking a hole in it, and he used the second knife to stab Nicola 11 times. She used all of her strength to try and get to the dormer window in her bedroom, but she was stabbed through the heart. At 11:15 p.m, Sinead rang the emergency services to tell them that they had been attacked. She could hear Nicola moaning, but had no idea how badly injured she was, as she was lying on her stomach. 5 minutes later, Nicola's phone rang. It was her mum, who had earlier promised to call back when she got the baby to sleep. Sinead had to answer the phone and tell them what happened.
And I remember telling her mom that, because the phone was in my hand, that Nicola had been hurt, but that we were getting help, that someone was coming to help us and we'd be fine and everything would be fine, but that she had gotten hurt, but everything would be okay.
The intruder was gone and the Gardaí had just arrived. Josephine and John were in London, unable to get answers about what happened to their daughter. Nicola's mum rang back and spoke to Garda John Reardon. When she asked if she could speak to her daughter, the Garda was confused and said she just had. As Josephine told him that Sinead wasn't her daughter, another Garda whispered in his ear that there was another woman in the bedroom, and they couldn't find a pulse.
When the Garda arrived at Underwood House, they first had to put the code in to open the 8-foot electric gates. The 100-yard driveway leading up to the house was the only access for the patrol vehicles. The Garda entered the house, and even in the dark they could see blood covering the floor and leading up the stairs. Following the trail that went into Nicola's room where they found her unresponsive on the floor, Sinead collapsed. She'd lost a lot of blood but managed to give the Garda a description of the attacker. A slim white male with a shaved head and a goatee.
My mom and dad and my brother were there at that point as well. And they were all in at the house. Nicola was still in her room being assessed. I was on the stairs being treated and giving the guards my description of him and, you know, really going in and out of consciousness. I was told to the guards at the time they thought that I was going to die. They thought a couple of times there that was it because I'd completely tapped out. And anyway, I gave them the description of who had done this, what I can remember, what he looked like, what he was wearing. And even though he had obviously changed his clothes, they were aware that there was a person fitting that description outside.
When the description was passed to the Garda members outside, they immediately spotted someone matching that description. They were standing at the end of the driveway. When the man was approached and confronted, he said, "It was a pity I didn't do more." The attacker was 19-year-old Peter Whelan.
My mom had just come into the house before that, and she was obviously horrified and panicked seeing me at the top of the stairs, just covered in blood. She said it looked like I'd been attacked by a shark because there was just skin coming off my arms. There was just blood everywhere, all up the walls. It was horrific. So she had to take a minute to go outside, and she sat out at the front of the house on a windowsill, and she noticed this man and a younger boy standing in the driveway. And I mean, really far up the driveway now. This wasn't at the end of the gate on the road. They had walked all the way up the hill to the back of the house. And, you know, she really took them in. She noticed them because it was so strange that they were there, because the only other people on the scene were obviously paramedics and Gardaí and my brother and my dad. So she said to the man standing there, "Who is that boy?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know him." And the man standing there was actually Peter Whelan's uncle. And she said Peter Whelan was just staring at her. And then the guards came out to take him away. And then they walked off quietly. And then all of a sudden there was a huge commotion and there was a girl screaming. I think it was his sister. And, you know, it was reported at the time that he just started asking the guards, "Oh, what's the house like inside there?" As if he really wanted to know the damage that he had done from another person's perspective. It's really frightening and chilling for me. The fact that he was able to, within minutes, just completely mask his demeanor and act like a concerned neighbor, and to actually be able to do that, to be that manipulative and that Machiavellian and evil is really frightening, and a real insight into the fact that this is a sociopath. This is someone who could have had the potential to be a serial killer. This is not an empathic human being at all. He had no empathy for human life or really any remorse or flicker of shame for anything that he had done that night. And I was told then, even in the house, when the guards had led him to his house to question him, and he took out the clothes, the bloodstained clothes from his cupboard, and another knife. And I mean, they thought he was going to pounce on them with the knife and continue this violent, manic spree of murder.
Whelan was known to the Gardaí, having been arrested for assaults the previous December. Whelan and his friends had tried to crash a private New Year's party, and when they were refused entry, they came back brandishing bottles and hurleys and assaulted the young partygoers. After this, Whelan was admitted to a treatment centre in Limerick by his parents to try and curb his alcohol and behaviour issues. He remained in the treatment programme until the middle of April, and just a few weeks later, he would carry out a completely random and brutal attack.
Whelan had a history of violent and disordered behaviour leading up to the night that Nicola died. I mean, after the fact, we heard about he had broken into a local children's creche and urinated all over the toys and computers there. There was another attack on girls with hurleys at New Year's Eve. You know, this was a seriously dangerous individual. And on the night that Nicola died, he had previously been in the Rochestown Inn and with friends. He wasn't drinking himself, but there was some commotion there anyway, and he went as far as to try and smash a glass ashtray over a barman's head, which was when the guards were called, and they spoke to him and sent him home saying that there was a summons waiting for him from that attack on the girls at New Year's Eve. And as he was walking home, he noticed a younger boy on the road, and he wanted to kill him with a rock, but decided it was too messy. And he went back into his house to collect some of the knives that he had stored and came back out. And it was then that obviously the boy must have been gone, that he scaled the walls and the gates to Nicola's driveway and entered her house.
He turned off the lights in each room as he walked through the hall towards the voices upstairs. After carrying out his vicious attack on Nicola, he was unable to find Sinead downstairs, so he left. He dropped one of the knives on his way out of the garden and went to his house just two doors down to change out of his blood-soaked clothes. Whelan brazenly returned to the scene of the crime to relish in his work. He walked up the drive and asked the Gardaí what the scene was like inside. Once Sinead gave her description, Peter Whelan was arrested at the scene and questioned the next morning.
After he killed Nicola, he was looking for me. He wasn't too sure if I'd died somewhere or I'd managed to flee the garden and was walking around with the knife that he had used to kill Nicola, which he eventually discarded in the shrubbery there. And he went home, washed off the blood, changed his clothes, and sat down to have a cigarette with his mom in the kitchen. At that point, there would have been wailing ambulances and police cars arriving at the scene two doors up from his house.
Whelan told the Gardaí, "I should have done lots more. It's in my head. He told me to do it. He did. I don't know why I did it. I was going to kill myself or someone else. I didn't have the courage to do it to myself." He confirmed that he didn't know Nicola or Sinead. He just picked the house at random, saying it could have been anybody. When the Gardaí asked Whelan what happened, he said he took two knives from his home before going into the Sweeney house through an unlocked door. He heard voices upstairs, so went in and saw a girl sitting on the bed and started stabbing her. Another girl came out of the bathroom, and he just started stabbing her, everywhere and anywhere, before running downstairs and going home.
And then the next thing I remember just being in the ambulance and again just asking, "Where is Nicola? What's going on?" Because I was very panicked asking about Nicola, and obviously they couldn't tell me at that stage what was going on. They had told me that she was in another hospital and that we'd get the best care if we had gone to separate places, not to overload everyone. I just remember being in the hospital then, even that night, and just kind of being hyper, really hyper. And I just kept asking about her. And I suppose there was kind of this kind of sense of relief that things were, that you had gotten help, you know, that we were going to be okay, there was help. And then I think around 3 or 4 in the morning, one of the nurses had to come in and tell me that she had died, which was, yeah, that was the hardest. It kind of all went black then for me, I think. I think up until, you know, a few hours before that point, I was kind of high on the fact that we had both survived, I think. And yeah, I remember I always remember getting that news and just getting so dark because I was just so just lost. I was so heartbroken that's how that Nicola died. Like, I couldn't even accept that. You know, it was a really hard thing to undertake.
The following morning, Detective Garda John Reardon charged Whelan with murder and assault. Whelan said, no, no, when asked if he had any response to the charges. Peter Whelan was brought to a special sitting of Cork District Court, having been charged with the murder of Nicola Sweeney, an assault causing harm in regards to the brutal attack on Sinead O'Leary, who was recovering in hospital. The court granted Whelan legal aid, ordered a psychiatric assessment, and remanded the defendant into custody.
There was just so much to try and process that, especially that first few months. You're trying to recover from really intense physical injuries, which were crazy. I was black and blue all over. Like, I had 3 stab wounds to my chest, 2 to my stomach, 1 to my back. I had 2 big ones on my wrist on my left arm, and then my right arm, just like I'd like a few that went through my hand, through my upper arm. There's a good few go through my upper arm, and then in my lower arm, there's about 5 separate ones. 2 of them go straight through my arm and out. So just even being in that physical state, I remember just feeling so weak and vulnerable. And then the shock of what actually happened that night and that Nicola had died were 2 huge separate things to try and come to terms with and process as well. Like, that night, it was something that we, particularly in Ireland, like, everyone finds Ireland very safe. Like, things like that don't happen.
Josephine and John Sweeney returned home from London that evening. Their house was cordoned off for forensic examination, so they had to spend the night in a hotel. Sean had raced back to the house the night before when his father had called him to let him know something bad had happened to Nicola. When he arrived, the police were already there. Nicola reposed in Glen Bay, County Kerry, in her father's hometown where she spent many summers before. The next morning, May 2nd, mourners gathered at St. James's Church. The chief celebrant was Father Charles Owen, a family friend who had known Nicola since she was a child. Father Owen spoke of Nicola's loves, music, particularly Michael Jackson, animals, learning, and her friends and family. Father Owen said, "I had known Nicola since she entered St. Joseph's School at the age of 5. She showed qualities that were truly remarkable and special. She had a unique, loving nature. She cared about people and was generous and kind to all she came in contact with. She loved animals and cared deeply about their welfare. Her modesty and humility and her sensitivity were wondrous in such a young person. She had a wonderful sense of humour, with a delightful smile. One of the things that stood out was her inquiring mind. She was always questioning and wanting to know about everything. She had an insatiable appetite for knowledge. All these traits were fostered and nurtured by her parents, who brought their family up in a loving way, always encouraging them to reach their full potential. I had been over to Cork for her little brother's christening, at which I officiated, and this was a very happy occasion for all the family. I wish I could explain why such a terrible thing would happen to such a beautiful girl. In the days ahead, difficult days for all the family, all of us must not give way to despair. Her life has not been in vain. Nicola was an example to us all, especially young people. We must live our lives as she lived hers, a life of love, a sincere life, and a life of compassion. This is what she stood for, and this is what we must stand for, if we are to cherish her memory." As Mass ended, Nicola's father John told those in attendance that Nicola had lit up their lives during her 20 short years. A guard of honour was formed by Nicola's old classmates and college friends before she was buried at Churchtown Cemetery, Beaufort, in the shadow of the McGillicuddy Reeks near Killarney.
I was in hospital for a week or two. So I remember not being able to go to Nicola's funeral. I would have been allowed go, but we thought maybe for my mental health, travelling down to Killarney and seeing a lot of people and stuff, because there were so many aspects of that. I didn't see anyone for like just a few close friends for a long time, and, you know, kind of hiding in my house, sleeping, and my dog was sleeping in the room with me all the time. Because I remember even in the hospital itself, I remember even being on a ward and seeing other people at the other sides of the curtain was just upsetting me. I didn't want to see anyone. I was really, I suppose, just shocked and scared and needed to be in the most comfortable place possible at that stage. So I remember being really happy to get home, but still being very debilitated physically as well as mentally, of course. But like physically, I couldn't do anything for myself at all because of the manner in which my arms were and everything. Because I remember like a friend in hospital, Andrew, having to come in after, it was after days, and helping me to wash my hair and still having blood under my fingernails and stuff days later and things. It's just, I don't know. It was like there was the road to recovery from it was had so many different facets that first year was just, God, I don't even remember a lot of it. Even it was just trying to get through the day, trying to function again, trying to make sense A, of what happened and why it happened, and who Peter Whelan was too was a huge aspect of it, trying to find out who this person was who murdered your best friend and tried to kill you. Like, who was he? How did he even get that far? Why did that happen?
On October 31st, Peter Whelan was brought to the Central Criminal Court in Dublin. The trial was set for January 20th, 2003. In December, Peter Whelan decided to plead guilty to the murder of Nicola Sweeney and the attempted murder of Sinead O'Leary. The court date was scheduled for December 20th, 2002. Just days before, the Sweeneys would spend their first Christmas without Nicola. They had to go to the full courts to watch as her killer was sentenced. When a defendant pleads guilty, there is no trial. No evidence has to be presented, but a family member is allowed to make a victim impact statement. The Sweeneys arrived early to the criminal courts that morning to speak with the state prosecutor about process. They were only granted 15 minutes of his time, while he told them the statement would be irrelevant because in Ireland, there is a mandatory life sentence for murder. Disappointed but undeterred, the Sweeneys were adamant that they, along with Sinead O'Leary, would let the court and Peter Whelan hear exactly what he had done to them. When they returned to the courtroom, it was already filled with journalists, spectators, and in the seats, their son Sean was trying to save for them, sat Peter Whelan's family. This was traumatising for the Sweeneys, who had to try and find other seats at their own daughter's murder trial. Nicola's killer had his family's support as he sat at the defence table, while Nicola and Sinead's family were trying to remain composed in the same room as the man who ruined their lives.
You know, I was met with the same dark, evil person again in court 8 months later. The courtroom was chilling. It was really frightening. You'd expect just on some level there'd be some flicker of remorse there or some level of shame, but there wasn't. It was just this arrogant, evil, dark person standing in the courtroom acting like he hadn't done anything wrong, as if he was entitled to do what he had done. And there was no regard for the suffering he had inflicted on Nicola or me, or the trauma that he had left her family with. There was court reporters at the time saying it was just so chilling in that room that it really cut them to their core, and they were still left with that now, today, looking back on it. And even, I know there was a couple of guards who had been there that night at the scene who had to even take time off work to process the trauma that they had seen, the horror that they had seen in Nicola's house. It was just unbelievable, and many guards I've met since then and everything have said, obviously, that is a case and a crime scene that has never left them. It was so horrific. It was unlike anything they'd ever expect to see in a house in Ireland from a call out like that.
Alice Fawcett for the prosecution relayed the events of the night Peter Whelan attacked Nicola and Sinead. It was clear that Sinead's life was saved because Whelan had been focused on Nicola. Dr. John Harbinson, state pathologist, carried out the post-mortem on Nicola Sweeney. He found that her death was caused by a single stab wound to the chest that penetrated her heart and caused hemothorax. Hemothorax is a collection of blood in the space between the chest wall and the lungs. This puts pressure on the lungs and can cause them to collapse. Superintendent Brian Callahan gave an account of the events of the night ending with Whelan being arrested after being discovered at the scene. He also disclosed that Whelan had spent 3 months in rehab for substance abuse just 2 weeks prior to the attack. Mr. Gulbeck for the defence said, "I can offer no explanation, excuse or evidence. This was a terrible crime. It was a sacrifice without any reason." Whelan barely lifted his head, only speaking twice to plead guilty to the charges. Sinead bravely read her own victim impact statement, saying how her life was now a struggle to survive at just 20 years old. She spoke of how she feared her own memories and how any good memories of Nicola had been tainted by the murder. She told the court that what kept her going was the fight to get Nicola justice.
Having to face the monster that had violently murdered my friend and attempted to kill me was obviously no easy feat. Having to go to that courtroom the way it was designed, I had to walk within a few feet of him, and you know, it was an option. I didn't have to take the stand and give a witness statement, but I knew how important it was at this point for the sentencing to really appeal to the judge, to really get an insight of what me and Nicola suffered that night. And the trauma that I would continue to live with. And it still really haunts me looking back at that time and not seeing any ounce of remorse from him. You know, just seeing a real evil sociopath standing there arrogantly. You'd expect some remorse, something, you know. But there was just nothing. There was just nothing at all.
John Sweeney then stood and read his own statement. It read as follows. Our world, as we knew it, ended on April 26th. Before this, we were a happy family. Life before this was happy and content. We looked forward to the day we would hold Nicola's children. Now we have memories that torment us. They torment each one of us. She was butchered in a most monstrous way after begging for the life of Sinead O'Leary. The evil lust to kill. Those are our memories. My wife has spent time in hospital. Both of us are on medication constantly. I toss and turn at night trying to block out those horrific memories, but the torment will go on as long as we live on this earth. My wife is much worse. She locks herself in her room wanting to die. Sean tries to block it out by pretending she's gone on a trip around the world. Christopher, our little son, wonders where his only sister has gone. Our house, which Nicola picked and loved, is still perfect. We find it impossible to believe that she is gone. John appealed to the presiding judge, Mr. Justice Paul Carney, to sentence Whelan to life in prison for Nicola's murder and 70 years for the attempted murder of Sinead O'Leary. Justice Carney told Whelan that the only mitigating factor was that he'd pleaded guilty.
For the crime of murdering Nicola, Judge Carney imposed a mandatory life sentence, and for the crime of attempting to murder me, he imposed a sentence of 15 years. But he directed for this sentence to be consecutive to the life sentence, which was hugely important and a new departure in sentencing. And something that should really be happening moving forward.
Just a year after killing Nicola, Peter Whelan appealed his sentence on the ground that it was unlawful to impose a consecutive sentence, as a life sentence meant that the convicted person remains in prison or on license until their death. The average time served of a life sentence in Ireland is between 18 and 19 years. Concurrent sentences run at the same time.
Crimes should never be served concurrently, I don't believe. If I was to go out and get a load of speeding fines or parking tickets, I wouldn't be paying concurrently. I'd be paying separately and penalised separately for each of those small crimes. So in that respect, it's hard to understand why something so severe as the crime of murder can have a term to run concurrently with other sentences. I know that Whelan was sentenced as well for the attack on the girls on New Year's Eve. I think he received 11 months for that, but that, of course, did run concurrently. But it was made very clear by Judge Carney that this sentence for me and Nicola had to be run consecutively, you know, because it was what he could do within his power to ensure that Whelan would remain in prison for a very long time, which he clearly needed to. You know, someone that violent and disordered is a huge danger to the public, you know, and it was clear that that is what Judge Carney wanted to get across.
Whelan's sentence was not reversed, but the order was. Whelan was to serve 15 years in prison for the attack on Sinead O'Leary before beginning his life sentence for the murder of Nicola Sweeney. Whelan appealed again, but this was also dismissed as being inappropriate. It was a constitutional challenge of sentencing structure that was found to be utterly without merit in law. Despite pleading guilty, he believed his sentence was a breach of his human rights, and the appeals have further traumatised the Sweeneys and Sinead O'Leary, who've attended court each time.
I remember finding that aspect of it really hard. The constant appeal. Because, I mean, I was fighting to try and come to terms with what had happened to Nicola, what had happened to us, and to heal physically and mentally from that attack. And, you know, obviously, Nicola's murder really rocked the community. There's very few people that you'd meet now in Cork that wouldn't remember that. You know, it shocked the community. It frightened everyone to understand that there was this evil and disordered sociopath within the community that could have endangered anyone's lives. So there was huge media interest in the case. And even more so because of the appeals process, for me, it just felt never ending, particularly the first few years. And it really hindered any chance I had to kind of process what had happened and to try and pick up the pieces and move on with my life. But I did, I got there.
The Sweeneys set up a foundation and website called the Nicola Sweeney Foundation. The link will be in our show notes. The foundation campaigns for justice for the families of murder victims and highlights the insensitivities within the judicial process for those bereaved by homicide. The foundation aims to serve as a contact point for the families and friends of homicide victims and offer assistance and advice in the wake of such a tragedy. They also want a more balanced justice system, where a life sentence means life, and that the family of the victim are consulted before a murderer is considered for parole. Sinead spoke about the effect the attack had on her and how it impacted and continues to impact her life almost two decades later.
Although I had wounds to my stomach and my chest and my back, it was my arms that, because I'd used my arms as a shield essentially and thrown them into the knives and used them to protect my vital organs, that my arms suffered a huge amount of damage. I had big surgeries on my arms to try and repair the nerves and the tendons and the muscles and everything. I mean, they were a mess, particularly my right arm. It was such a mess. I remember getting my bandages off a few days later in the hospital and just looking down at it was like a patchwork quilt. There was just hundreds of stitches. I'd lost the ability to really, for my arms to even function at this stage. My whole body was bruised head to toe from being stamped on. I was swollen and in pain and, you know, left there so vulnerable from what had happened to me and so physically weak because of my injuries. I mean, I had to learn to do everything again from scratch with writing, and even when I'd be holding things in the kitchen, I'd drop things. You know, especially that first year was really hard to have to cope with that physical change and put all my efforts into healing from that. I mean, I'll never regain full function of my right arm. You know, there's a lot of nerve damage there and a lot of pain. But, you know, you learn to adapt and you learn to do things in different ways. Although I had spent my 20th birthday in hospital a few days after Nicola was murdered. And then I would continue to spend that decade of my life, that period in my 20s of not only trying to physically recover from what happened, but to mentally recover as well, which is an even harder task. But I mean, the mental side of it was just torturous. You know, coming off the back of that night, you're just, for the body to be impacted and the brain to be impacted by such an immense and horrific trauma, it almost rewrites everything that you know, everything that you took, you know, things that you would just take for granted, like being okay in the dark. I was not okay in the dark anymore. I became terrified of the dark and what could be there, you know, and it's just going back to coming out of that bathroom in the dark and finding Nicola and trying to get his help and being aware that Whelan was still on the property and could finish me off, you know, that was huge. And I remember at home just being afraid of the dark in the evenings, and you're on high alert and your body is shocked and anxious and in that fighting mode all the time. And no matter how you can try and rationalize it to yourself and calm yourself down, your brain has seen that you can be in the comfort and the security and the peace of your home, like Nicola's home in her bedroom in your safest place. Murderer can come in and take your life, you know? That doesn't just go away. That doesn't just leave the body. That lives in the body. I'd say 10 years after, I mean, at 30 years of age, being in my parents' house and, you know, needing to just go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you know, normal things. And getting up to go and going to my bedroom door and having to open my door into that dark hallway, into my home. My family are there, sleeping in their beds. And it was unbelievably difficult to do that, to do something so simple. Because your mind goes straight to the fact that your whole family could be massacred outside the door, and how could you come out of that door? What could be there? What danger would you be in? And I remember being really thankful for the fact that my dad was a loud snorer, because I'd just listen out until I could hear him snoring, and then that would give me the sign that everything was okay and I could come out of my bedroom. I had a lovely dog when Nicola died, and she really helped me with, she'd, you know, sleep in my room every night. And she died a few months later, and then my dad had heard about this giant dog that was on like a choke lead up in Sundaysville. She was young, but she was a bit aggressive, so she was being put down or whatever, unless someone would take her and could work with her. And then I was like, oh my God, taking her, fell in love with her. She was this giant black bear. Her name was Lucky, and being a German Shepherd, she was hugely overprotective of me, and she really was instrumental in my recovery at that stage. She really helped with small steps of just being able to walk around my neighborhood when it got dark. You know, for years, that was a challenge. And God, she was unbelievable. It would have been really hard to start doing normal things like that again without her, because I felt so safe and protected when I was with that dog. I eventually had to leave Cork and leave Ireland. I think it was all just getting too much, and I really needed space and time away from it all. and to get away from all the trauma and the loss and the pain and everything that Peter Whelan had inflicted on us all. And like, everything was tainted. Everything that I knew here was tainted. Everything reminded me of what happened. Everything brought me back to that. And I knew that I needed to get away and to really challenge myself and really focus on how this one night had completely changed my life and completely changed how I did everything. And I ended up for a time working with turtles in Costa Rica. It was walking the beaches at night in the dark, looking for nesting turtles and collecting their eggs and bring them back to a hatchery. There would be poachers on the beach at night who'd carry machetes, which is a normal thing to carry in Costa Rica. It's like someone carrying a pocket knife or a bottle opener. You know, they're part of life there. And although it's something that I hadn't directly sought out, it's where I ended up. And that was going to be a huge challenge, huge, huge, just, but it's something that I was determined to follow through with, no matter how afraid I was. And it really helped, just continuously walking in the dark at night, having to normalize knives around me and things like that, and really push myself. I pushed myself really hard to do that process and to continuously do it until eventually I had kind of some peace in my mind with what had happened. I've always been open with talking about my trauma, and I know how important that is to the process. And I met many people from all walks of life all over the world, and I told them my story and Nicola's story. And I felt it was time then for me to come back home and to really start living my life. Because Peter Whelan definitely took all of that from me, any chance of me living a normal life. Like, I turned 20 a few days after Nicola was murdered, and almost losing my own life. And, you know, that's the time of your life that you really begin to start out and live as an adult and carve your own path. And, you know, you see people really getting somewhere with colleges and their career and moving forward and starting families. But I was in a completely different boat altogether. I think the PTSD from it all left me with a sense of not even being able to visualize a future. I was so focused on just getting through the day and getting through the night for a long time. It was all consuming for that decade. It really was. But in my 30s, I was determined to, you know, I've always been very determined to not let things break me and to push through, and that you fight, you always fight. You keep fighting. And, you know, I kept fighting for peace in my life, and I felt that I was definitely on a good road of getting there. And I'd moved back to Cork, and I was happy and I was settled here. It was exactly what I needed to come back to my friends and my family and everyone that I loved, and really look forward to the future and look forward to really living a life now. I mean, I'm still, what is it, like 17 years on with terrible nerve damage, still issues with my arms functioning and things. But, you know, I've always taken the mindset that I'm lucky to have my life. So, you know, that's just, I just kind of have to overcome having nerve pain in my arms and functioning problems. I have my life, I'm alive. Like,
the presiding judge in Whelan's case, Judge Paul Kearney, died in 2015. He was the most distinguished criminal judge in Ireland, who had spent over 50 years working in the justice system. It was his decision that Whelan was to serve a life sentence and a consecutive 15 years for the attempted murder of Sinead.
I mean, I often wonder now, when I look at the way the sentencing has actually played out, would things have gotten this far had Judge Kearney still been alive today? Because he most certainly would have been the first person that I would have appealed to during this last year, when I found out the real way in which the Department of Justice had dealt with this case. Even following the trial, it was almost immediate that Whelan's legal team challenged the consecutive nature of the sentencing. And, you know, they argued that you couldn't have a sentence consecutive to a life sentence because the life sentence is for life. But the three appeal court judges simply just turned the sentences around, directing that Whelan would serve 15-year sentence first for attempted murder before he even began his life sentence. You know, and we kind of had to accept that at the time. And, you know, you kind of felt somewhat secure in the knowledge that Whelan should really, based on those sentences, probably spend a minimum of 35, 40 years in prison before parole would even be an option. You still get nervous then because the appeals, it just kept coming. You know, Whelan and his legal team were relentless at taking every opportunity that they could to bring this case to the High Court, to the Supreme Court, and eventually to the European Court, based on some human rights issues is what he was arguing there. And it's such a kick in the teeth, it really is. It's just so shocking and disrespectful to Nicola's memory and justice for Nicola that, you know, he was able to focus his time while serving my sentence to trying to fight having to ever even serve a day of her sentence. You know, I still find it just frightening and despicable that our system would allow someone with no remorse and accountability for the crimes that they've committed, that they would be allowed to focus on just getting out of prison rather than having to participate in a program to rehabilitate, which I don't even believe would even be possible with someone like Whelan.
Peter Whelan's 15-year sentence was reduced to 11 years in 2013. He has been allowed supervised visits to Cork City. He served his sentence for the attempted murder of Sinead, but just 7 years into his life sentence, he has been granted temporary release at least 4 times.
Last year, it was early in the summer, I think it was June. You know, I found out from a third party, as did Nicola's parents, that Peter Whelan had in fact met with the parole board 3 times at this stage. And off the back of that, he was granted day releases to see his family in Cork, 1 every 3 months. And the night that I found out about that, I mean, I couldn't process the information. I couldn't process it. I just couldn't. I couldn't understand how this had happened and how I didn't know, how no one sought to inform me, how I wasn't a consideration. You know, I'd obviously followed the appeals process, and in my mind, we were at the stage where Whelan would have, you know, just come out of finishing his 15-year sentence for attempted murder and would only have been a couple of years at the very beginning of his life sentence for Nicola. I got sick. I was really sick. I remember physically getting sick, vomiting. I couldn't function for a good few days. And I also couldn't get any answers. No one could answer my questions as to why this had happened. No one. I was frantic. I was ringing guards. I remember turning up at Anglesey Street Station and just being like demanding that someone speak to me, that someone talk to me and explain to me what had happened here. What is going on here? And there was nothing. I met the superintendent there of serious crime who would make comments, who actually remembered me from that night. And that was comforting in a sense, because I was like, oh, right. OK, I've met someone who knows exactly what I'm talking about, knows what I lived through, knows what happened to me and Nicola, and knows how much of a danger Peter Whelan is. But, you know, Mick explained to me that this was the jurisdiction of the parole, the prison, that it was up to them to inform me, and that even when these day releases would be taking place, he'd be accompanied by prison officers, but the guards in the area wouldn't even be aware that he would be coming into Cork for the day, that it was completely out of their hands. And that, couldn't believe that either. Just what? How is that even the case? And apparently that's the case in case a guard has an outstanding grudge with a prisoner, that the prisoner is protected from the guards even knowing about these day releases. Obviously, they'd be informed if he was to get eventual release. But even these day releases, I was like, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that information. The few days after finding out that he had been in Cork and everything was just, it was mind-blowing. I couldn't process it. I couldn't rationalize it. I've been quite lucky in life that I'm a very rational person, and it's definitely helped me in order to recover from what happened and to heal from what happened, you know. But this, I couldn't understand it. And it was only within a few days that I found out that RT's Primetime were doing a special investigative report on it. They were as outraged as we were. They couldn't understand how a violent and disordered murder had essentially bypassed the legal system, was sitting before parole board years before he was entitled to, and in fact had been granted day releases in Cork. And yet, Nicola's family and I had no idea. We had no inclusion. We were completely disregarded, not even considered in this process. It was so frightening and so shocking to me. And then you're faced with going ahead and being involved in that interview, you know, on a public forum, relaying your trauma and putting yourself out there again. It was something I knew I had to do, because I really believed that it would help expose what was happening and that a change would be made, that the wrongs that had happened so far would be rectified. I had a few weeks to prepare and kind of get my head together and, you know, not only process what had happened, the situation that we were now in, but the danger that I was putting myself in by putting up this roadblock to Whelan's release, I suppose. You know, he doesn't see himself as accountable at all for what happened. So who does he hold accountable? Does he hold me accountable for him being in prison? How much danger am I putting myself in there, putting myself out there again and making myself so public with this? And then preparing for the fact that once the documentary did air, that this would become all so public again and so all consuming and, you know, having your face out there on so many people's televisions and to become a talking point again was really hard. It was hard. And in all of that, having no support from any government body at all with it. But I went forward with it. I knew it was what I had to do. I had to do it not only for Nicola and for myself and Nicola's family, but for the community and the safety of the community. You know, I was haunted with the thoughts of what could happen if Whelan was to walk free in a few years' time and to kill someone else's child. To inflict that pain and horror on someone else. To inflict that trauma on another family. And it's not just the family. The ripple effects of homicide are huge in the amount of people it affects. I mean, it's criminal. It's criminal, really, the way that we have been treated. The way I see it, my life is in danger from Peter Whelan. He's been unremorseful for what he did to me. And the only thing he's been quoted as saying is that he wished he had done more to ensure that I was dead. Yet I'm not informed when I could bump into him on the street. He had 4 years shaved off his sentence for me and only served 11 years and I wasn't told. And the same again, that people that heard about this, and, you know, even friends at the time and people that had reached out after seeing Primetime felt the same. They were like, I would have assumed he'd never be allowed back to Cork. I can't believe that that's not just standard when it comes to homicide. But it's not. It's not. We are so behind in this country. So behind. There is no support or no regard for victims of homicide and their families and the people that are left behind. There's no support to help them pick up the pieces and rebuild their lives and to help them be mentally protected from those murderers coming back into their lives. There's nothing there at all. It's really shocking, really shocking. And it's disgusting. It's a disgusting way to treat people. Time and time again in this process, it is made clear to me that a dangerous murderer, his rights are more important than mine. His rights to life are more important than mine, even though he's serving a life sentence. He is constantly being put first over me and Nicola's family. I mean, the family of victims and homicide are left with their own life sentences. Dealing with that loss and that grief, it does not get any easier. In fact, it gets worse over the passage of time. It gets harder. Every birthday and anniversary, you are more aware of what was taken from their lives and what you have lost. We all play many roles in life. Nicola had so many roles to play and so many roles that she would have played, not just a daughter, but an aunt, a mother, a grandmother. All of that was taken from her. She was so young when she died. She was 20 years of age. And she was violently murdered in her bedroom in the house that she loved, the house that she chose and the house that she felt safe in. And she, her life is lost in all of that. What she lost, I feel, is lost in the system. There's no acknowledgement of that. And then there's no acknowledgement of what was taken from her family and her friends. What they have been robbed of. And you know, it's so harrowing to really see what Nicola's family have suffered. The loss, the huge loss that they've suffered. There's no greater crime than murder. And have your child murdered. I can't think of anything worse. And yet they are completely failed by the system. Completely let down, not even acknowledged at all, it seems. I mean, I often think now of what Nicola would be doing now, and would she be a mother now, and where would her life have taken her, because she was such a vibrant, vivacious girl who really took life by the reins. She was someone who was really just on the cusp of starting her journey in life. She had so much ahead of her. So much ahead of her. I was even reading through her end of year book the other day from when we were 18 from school that everyone had wrote in, and you know, it was the same thing again and again. Can't wait to see how life works out for you, you know, and best of luck with the future. And that future was taken from her. Nicola was such an easygoing person. She was a really light-hearted person. She, do you know, even reading those comments from people, all the girls we were in school with, everyone would say, do you know, she was just such a laugh to be around, and she always had a smile for everyone. And, you know, she'd worked in the bars growing up for her parents. And at that time, she was still working in Brown Thomas Cafe. And she was just such a social girl in that respect. And everyone loved Nicola. Everyone loved chatting to Nicola. You know, she just didn't really take life too seriously. She was such a positive person, whereas I was a bit darker in my teenage years, but I was definitely very attracted to that energy. And, you know, she taught me not to take life so seriously and not to get so stressed out by it all. And she was someone who was really going places. She was a real beautiful, statuesque person, tall, beautiful, blonde girl. And even though she seemed so confident, there was this lovely innocence and shyness about Nicola, and this, you know, when you got to really know her, this the self-doubt that was there. And you know, she was really such a lovely, lovely girl. She had a heart of gold. She had time for everyone. You know, she was a vegetarian. She loved animals. She was just a great, great person.
Any prisoner serving a sentence longer than 8 years are allowed to apply for parole halfway through that sentence. Being approved for parole would grant them early release from prison. Someone sentenced to life in prison can apply after just 7 years. The parole board is an administrative collection of members who advise the Minister for Justice and Equality on the applications for long-term prisoners. The members include senior officials from the Department of Justice and Equality, the head of probation service, the medical director and Central Mental Hospital, and various community representatives. At the moment, an applicant must go before a parole board who will assess their progress and examine how they have engaged in reformative work while in prison, and a number of other factors including whether it is reasonable to grant early release based on the nature of the offence, whether they want release, whether there are any compassionate grounds that would grant special consideration, whether they have engaged with therapeutic services within the prison, and whether their release would be considered a threat to the safety of the community. Their recommendation is passed to the serving Minister for Justice and Equality, who must then accept, deny, or accept in part. When a prisoner is not recommended for release, they will have their case reviewed every 1.5 to 3 years. This means that the families must prepare themselves to write a statement each time between the 7-year mark and when the perpetrator is eventually released on licence. A piece of legislation that would increase the minimum term served before convicted killers could apply for parole, to 12 years, was first proposed to the government in 2016. It was enacted in July 2019 and would mean that the parole board would become an independent body outside of the government, becoming more transparent and accessible for victims. The new parole board would be made up of people who are appointed by the Minister for Justice, who would have an understanding of the prison system, the law, and the impact on victims. This would remove politics from the parole process. The Parole Act was passed in 2019, and over a year later, it still has not been implemented.
I was contacted by the victim liaison in the prison a few weeks ago to inform me that a parole hearing was scheduled for November. This will be the 4th parole review, which was to allow me a few weeks to prepare and submit a victim impact statement. This came as a shock to a lot of people around me, considering what was exposed last year in the primetime investigation and the fact that we had received reassurances that this new Parole Act would apply retrospectively to Whelan's case. But here we are. I'm not surprised myself, given my treatment over the last year and my treatment ongoing in this process. In order to submit this statement, I had to give my consent for my submission to be included in the prisoner's parole file, in the knowledge that a copy would be given to the prisoner. I mean, that in itself is so wrong. It makes me as a victim even more vulnerable. And it just highlights even further how unbalanced the system is, and it really is in the favour of the prisoner. My voice does not count and is not acknowledged unless he has access to it. That's very discouraging for victims, and I can imagine a lot of victims would decline to submit a statement based on that. Preparing that statement was a very difficult and confronting process. I mean, how do you even begin to document the impact a life-changing event like that has had? And really do it justice. There's a lot of pressure there. I'm having to appeal to a parole board that, as far as I can see, hasn't considered me in the past, hasn't considered Nicola's family and their ongoing trauma. And in reality, hasn't really considered the position of the community and the danger that they're putting everyone in by releasing such a dangerous psychopath. Because that's what he is, and that's what he continues to reveal himself to be. Peter Whelan has all the traits of a psychopath, bar none. And this isn't just evident in the night that he murdered Nicola and tried to kill me, but in his behaviour leading up to the night and the years leading up to that and the offences that he committed. And it's really evident in his behaviour since that night. I mean, psychopaths are known for their selfishness, callousness, their violence. People are completely lacking in conscience and feeling for others. They selfishly take what they want and do what they please, violating social norms and expectations without the slightest sense of guilt or regret. This has been clearly evident in his time spent in prison. It hasn't been a time where he has accepted responsibility or accountability for his behavior or addressed any aspect of his offending behavior. It is a time where he has launched an assault on the judicial system itself. The relentless appeals, that hasn't shown any empathy for my suffering or the suffering of Nicola's family. And they haven't shown any accountability for the crimes that he's committed. Peter Whelan is so egocentric and grandiose that he believes he's above the law and not bound to it. He refuses to be held accountable for any of the crimes he has committed. I mean, we see here a deceitful and manipulative, dangerous individual who had the ability to completely mask his real murderous self just moments after slaughtering an innocent victim. And I really fear that the way in which the state has dealt with this case, it only reinforces his belief that he is in fact above the law and that he can get away with murder. It's really shocking that this has all happened, that we are in a position right now where a dangerous, violent psychopath has accessed a parole board for reviews 7 years before his life sentence was scheduled to commence. There are so many unanswered questions as to how and why he was allowed to access the board and why he was granted these releases so early into a sentence, because they're clearly an indication that the state are gearing him up for release. I mean, it's my understanding that the board must consider the reasons and recommendations of the trial judge and the nature and gravity of the offence. The late Judge Carney made it very clear that the sentences imposed on Whelan must be consecutive due to the sheer brutality of his actions and the consideration that he was a huge danger to society. And this sentiment has only been echoed by many judges who revisited this case through Whelan's relentless appeals to a sentence. And to me, this clearly has not been upheld by the parole board. All of those judges' views have been discounted. The decisions that have been made here utterly devalue Nicola's life and devalue my trauma. The degree of responsibility that the criminal has is taken into consideration when assessing some for parole. He clearly hasn't taken responsibility at all, or any accountability. The positions of the victims is supposed to be a consideration of the parole board. I can't see in any realm how I have been considered or how Nicola's family have been considered. The parole board's paramount consideration is the safety of the community. I don't believe the community has been considered at all here. A very violent and dangerous psychopath, a murderer, is clearly been given early release, been given temporary day releases, 4 years into a life sentence. It's shocking what is going on. It's really shocking. And it's negligent of not only me and Nicola's family, but of the community in general. The Department of Justice have done nothing for me but hinder my recovery. I feel utterly disposable. Things have got to change, and this is a prime opportunity for Minister McEntee to really enforce real and meaningful change. This act should be up and running by now. There should be no excuses at this stage as to why it's not. Like, and this is far bigger than any individual case. And the more time that passes, the more violent offenders are going before the parole board a mere 7 years into their life sentence under these existing outdated parole boards. And even when I'm saying that, I'm so aware that we didn't even get that 7 years of Nicola's life sentence. And we have no answer still as to why that happened. Why the state believes that a violent, unremorseful murderer should get special treatment. Why the general public isn't being protected from violent, disordered criminals. And I mean, moving forward, there has to be more change within this new board, you know? I believe the victims should have access to submissions from inmates as to why they should be considered for parole. My own personal victim impact statement that I'm writing at the moment, Peter Whelan will have access to that. So why shouldn't it work both ways? Why shouldn't we understand why the parole board and why the murderer believes that they should be allowed back into society? Why aren't we being included? This parole act has been on the table since 2016 and finally it was signed off last year, but it hasn't been enacted. This further highlights the lack of acknowledgement and consideration given to these innocent victims who have been horrifically traumatised and will live with that trauma for the rest of their lives. It's not the murderers who've been sentenced with life sentences that are actually serving them. It's the families of their victims. I mean, on average here, it's 19 years is all that's served for a life sentence. We're notorious for being lenient on murderers. We are being led to believe that there is a balance here and considerations are given to the suffering and trauma of the victims, but it's really hard to see that. The resounding theme in so many of these heartbreaking and harrowing stories is the real fear that these murderers are being released back into their communities. And it's happening all the time. And not only is that happening, but they're being blindsided by these temporary day releases, finding out in the media, and being blindsided by the fact that these criminals who have inflicted so much trauma on their lives are out on license. What is the department doing to alleviate these fears and to protect vulnerable people from further traumatization? Exclusion zones are commonplace in many countries. There's clear consideration given to the victims. I shouldn't have to live a life in fear of bumping into the man who murdered my best friend and tried to kill me. It's not acceptable and it shouldn't be happening. It really shouldn't. There's a clear negligence going on here. My trauma will stay with me for the rest of my life. And that needs to be considered. It needs to be acknowledged. And I need to be supported.
We'd like to thank Sinead for speaking with us and commend her incredible bravery as she continues to fight for her life and for justice for her best friend. Peter Whelan had the audacity to go back into the house and asked how it looked inside. He relished in the horror and suffering he had left in his wake and never showed any remorse for what he had done. If he ever gets out of prison, he poses a great risk to the community.
I'm hoping that people will sign the petition to urge Helen McEntee to finally implement this parole act. You know, we've been waiting years for this bill to be signed off and it finally was last year. And yet here we are, over a year later, and it hasn't been implemented. This delay has had real and traumatic consequences, not just for Nicola's family and I, but for other families who've been affected by homicide. We need your support. We have an Instagram page called Implement the Parole Act, and the link to the petition is in the bio. Thank you very much. The scales of justice need to be more balanced, and victims need to be recognised. This law needs to be put into operation with urgency.